Hello and welcome once again to Breakfast All Day a la carte. And I'm really excited this week because I've got something very different for you and a great friend of mine whose brain I'm excited to pick. Her name is Julia Kim, and she's a longtime casting director here in LA, and she's done fantastic and eclectic work, and I'm so thrilled to see you, first of all, because I like you. Hi.
I like you, too.
Welcome. Good to see you.
Thank you.
And I'm so interested in what you do and how you do it, and I want to talk about your beginnings and all of it.
Sounds good.
Can we do that?
Yes.
Okay. So like me, you are from Los Angeles.
Born and raised.
Okay. So that's really unusual.
Mm-hmm.
Why are there not more of us like this?
We're around, I think. It's just, it's becoming, you know, it's a great place to live. And so every time new crops of people come and add to the stew that Los Angeles is.
Yeah. So where in LA did you grow up?
Not far from where we're at right now, Mid-City, went to the West Side for my young elementary, junior high type years, and then moved to the San Fernando Valley. And Valley Girl was, I'm dating myself, but Valley Girl was a huge hit. So moving there was sort of like, oh gosh, I have all these preconceived notions of what the Valley is. And some of it is true. Yeah. It was fun.
Well, I grew up in the Valley too.
Okay.
I grew up in Woodland Hills. And okay. So I'm also going to date myself. I'm 46. And so I think we are ish around mm-hmm. the same age. Mm-hmm. But being in the Valley in the 80s was exciting. I mean, because first of all, I didn't realize that that song Valley Girl by Moon Unit Zappa was meant to be satire.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, oh, she's really funny.
Uh-huh.
I want to be like her.
Well, she name checks all her friends and Birmingham High, and there's certain high schools that she, I mean, she really localizes it mm-hmm. with those lyrics, because the Zappa family, I believe, was also, I don't know if they ended up in the Hollywood Hills, but they were very Valley friendly.
Right.
So, yeah, it was cool. And then Fast Times at Ridgemont High, mm-hmm. Fast Times mm-hmm. at Ridgemont High. Mm-hmm. So, the Valley was infamous.
Right. Where'd you go to high school?
I went to Grant High School, which is right next to Valley College.
Okay. So like Van Nuys-ish, Van Nuys, Sherman Oaks, they call it yeah. Valley Village now.
Yeah.
And so what was the Valley like in the 80s for you? Like, was it like the movie Valley Girl and Fast Times? Were you hanging out at the mall?
Totally.
my God.
The Valley was different because everyone had a pool.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you weren't rich, you had a pool because it was so damn ass hot.
It was, but you know what? I don't remember it being as hot as it is now. Like, global warming is real.
Yeah.
When it's 107 degrees in Woodland Hills,
yeah.
it was not that bad when I was growing up there.
No. Yeah, I mean, we spent a lot of time in the pool when we were kids, and I remember my lungs hurt after a day of swimming, and I was like, I wonder why that is. Well, gee, because we're breathing this smoggy LA air, and we're literally in the pool all day.
There, it was smoggier then, and
yeah.
because the Valley is like a bowl, it
yeah.
would like
there's no circulation,
cluster it,
yeah.
it all. And I forgot to ask you at the top of this, the question that I ask everybody who comes on my show: how do we know each other?
Mm. Through Film Independent and the
yes.
lovely people there that are doing such great work. And I mean, they were my dream tribe. You know, when I first got into casting, I would watch their very little watched simulcast of the award show. And I'm like, that's the cool crowd. I want to be in that crowd because they were making work that I really admired. So I'm so thrilled to be in, you know, in the community.
Yes, we will get to all of that eventually. But I realize this is the first question I ask everybody, but I'm just so happy to see you. I forgot to ask it. So yes. So you're growing up in the Valley. You are one of how many kids?
Two.
Okay. Older or younger brother or sister?
Older, and I have a younger brother.
Okay.
And he's here. My whole family's in within driving distance.
Okay. And your parents came from South Korea, right?
Yes.
Okay, so how old were they when they came here?
They were not married. They got married here, which is a rarity.
Usually you would meet and get married there and then come together.
Yeah.
Was that a scandal?
No, it's just that they were early immigrants, very early. And I hear stories about, you know, my dad wanted to go to New York because they're both classical musicians. They're vocalists.
Oh, wow.
And so my father wanted to head to New York City, where all the fine, you know, Juilliard and all of that exist, but my mother is more of a country girl and likes the open land, and she was very intimidated by living in that kind of environment. So she convinced my father. She came out here first, and then my dad came out, and then they got married here. So they were like one of the first ones to even have a car. And so to get together with other South Koreans or Koreans that were early immigrants, my dad was the guy that picked everyone up and got them to church, which was the social gathering place. And they lived here ever since.
So they came to LA. Mm-hmm. What part of LA did they come to? To the West Side?
No, they came to, Koreatown did not exist.
I was going to say, there wasn't the Koreatown that we have now.
There was no Koreatown. And so everyone was sort of like, wherever they landed, that's why my dad's car was so valuable, because it brought them together. Now they live like Orange Drive and La Brea.
So like two blocks from me. That's really funny. Yeah.
Yeah.
So what did they sing? Were they opera singers?
Opera singers, classical, like just opera is different than like a classical piece. Like they would sing folk songs, they would sing hymns, they would sing classical pieces, and certainly pieces from an opera, but I never saw them in an actual opera on stage.
Okay. So when they came here from Korea, like what was the plan? What was the dream to come here and be singers here as well?
Well, my father came to conduct the church choir.
Oh, wow.
So he was able to utilize his musicianship that way. And it was the job that he was like, you have to say, I'm coming to America, and yes, I have a secure job. So the church invited him to be their conductor. And so he sang and he conducted, and my mother sang in the choir. And the church is a very musical place. So they put little small ensemble groups together and instruments and all that. So
you grew up with music around the house. Can you sing?
I like to sing. I can hold a tune. I can hold a tune. I would never say, I'm very shy, so I don't do karaoke or anything like that. But I do like to sing.
But you got it in the DNA.
Yeah.
Did they speak Korean with you in the home?
Yes.
Okay. Was that your first language growing up?
Probably.
Okay. Can you still speak Korean at all? Okay.
Yeah. I would probably put my foot in my mouth if I was, greeting a dignitary or something. But for my parents, it works. I mix it up.
Okay. So I know that sometimes when immigrants come, it's really important to maintain the language and the culture and to pass it on. Mm-hmm. And some immigrants come and say, like, we're American now, we're speaking English, like, we're not speaking our native language.
Right.
But it was important to your family to instill all of that in you.
I'm glad that they did.
Yeah.
Now in hindsight, I had kimchi in my fridge and bulgogi and all that stuff that is now in the mainstream, and it blows my mind because my friends used to come over and be like, what the heck is this? Mom packed little seaweed slices in my elementary school lunch, and all the kids were completely freaked out by what that thin thing was. And I was embarrassed, I just wanted to assimilate like all kids did. So yeah, but now I am fully embrace it.
And now there are trucks that bring you kimchi and
they incorporate it on cooking shows.
It's amazing.
It's an ingredient on Chopped. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's amazing. So where does the love of film come from? Did you love movies as a kid growing up?
I did, but my parents did not expose me to a lot of going to films. Like probably just even the process of going to a movie theater was not even something on their radar. So I remember when I would hitch on my friends' family's movie outings, like my friends would always want to go see something that I wasn't that keen on, but the dad would be like, I'm going over here and watching this action movie or something a little more edgier. And I would be like, can I go with him? So, I went and saw, some probably not child appropriate films, but, they didn't freak me out. I had I just desired that much more than seeing like an cute animal movie or something.
So as a kid, you were drawn to more daring storytelling. Can you think of any of the movies that you saw as a kid that were really influential on you?
Saturday Night Fever.
Oh, wow. Right. And I look back, we saw like Fame, right? I was seven when I saw Fame, seven or eight. Like there's an abortion in Fame.
There's an abortion in Fame. There's a toplessness, the guy coercing Irene Cara to take off her top.
It's Treja Lee, Coco. It's Treja Lee.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. That is right.
That's Fame.
My mistake. Yeah.
No, that's Fame. But like Saturday Night Fever has, you know, people joking around about suicide on the Verrazano Bridge. And
yeah, I was really young. I was a little girl, but I remember there's a scene where Donna Pascal has like a handful of rubbers and she's showing John Travolta and he sort of is disgusted by her. And I didn't know what the heck that was in her hand. But yeah, it was exciting. I mean, not only did it show New York like in its rawest form in that sort of the New York that doesn't exist. But anyways, well, it's not the rawest form because, I mean, Panic in Needle Park and all of that's very raw.
But when you're a kid, though, it's exciting and it's kind of scary and kind of fun all at the same time. I mean, I remember seeing around that age, like Fast Times at Ridgemont High, as you mentioned, you know, and I look back now as the mom of a 9-year-old and like, would I want my kid seeing that just yet? Like, I think it was a different time and like parents either were more permissive or they just didn't know.
It was true.
We turned out fine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you hear about Quentin Tarantino and all these sort of filmmakers today that said their parents took them and treated them just like adults and knew they can handle it. So if I had a kid, I feel like I would do the same thing, you know, and not just shield them and say just it's all butterflies and love songs.
No, we took Nick to see Dunkirk when he was like 7. I mean, we let him watch Archer. He definitely sees things that most kids don't see, but I don't know. It's a tough thing. Like I saw The Shining when I was really young and it totally screwed me up.
Well, that is a hard one. I mean, that still would screw somebody up now.
Yeah. So you're watching movies as a kid. At what point does it occur to you that maybe this could be something that you do with your career? That it could be a field that you actually work in and thrive in?
Well, so I didn't get to grow up with movies, but once I got on my own or was old enough to kind of just check out stuff on my own, I was voracious. Mm-hmm. And so I always found indie films, for lack of, that wasn't even really a terminology, but I mean, it was always the films that were saying something weird or different and a story that was very like niche. I just really gravitated towards that. So I just loved the early, you know, pioneers of indie film. I mean, I wasn't around when Cassavetes was doing films, but I caught up with all of that stuff later on and I just still just is so strong and effective today with very little means.
I feel like we're really lucky living in a place like LA because I recall, you know, in high school or, you know, coming home from college and summer break, whatever, and going to the Lemley Theaters or what was then the Town and Country Theater in Encino, right? And they would show foreign films and they would show quote unquote independent films. And I have memories of seeing things like The Hairdresser's Husband, or one of my first things I saw at the New Art was Delicatessen, you know, or what's the one with Nicole Kidman and Tanya Newton and they're like at a boarding school?
The Others? No. Oh gosh. That's Flirting? Or?
Flirting, yes. I remember seeing that, you know, and coming back from college. Yeah. And so I feel like because we're in a place like LA, this is, you know, long before anything resembling streaming.
Yeah.
We were lucky to live in a city where there were a lot of small theaters like that. Yeah. Did you go to places like that growing up too?
Yeah. I loved the Town and Country and, they were the artsy theaters.
Right.
Like there was just a few around town, like the Rialto in Pasadena had certain, I mean, I know it was a standalone theater, so they had to play mainstream stuff, but they were pretty open with their, curation. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd have nights where it was like a weird sort of one-off playing. Yeah, we are lucky because my friends who live in small towns, they'd be like, we don't get that movie. I'm like, oh, I just saw the greatest movie, you know, Trees Lounge by Steve Buscemi, you know, they're like really oddball things that are a blip in the theater, but my friends would never get to see it because it would never make it in their town.
And now like IFC exists and the Sundance Channel exists and streaming exists so they can see it.
Yeah.
So you're in high school in the Valley. Where did you go to college?
I was supposed to go.
Oh, you didn't go to go.
I was supposed to go to CSUN. I was a accomplished classical pianist.
Oh, wow.
I played with the LA Phil.
Wow.
When I was 11.
That's huge.
At the Dorothy Chandler. And it was a African-American conductor named Calvin Simmons. It was Zubin Mehta.
Oh, my God.
And he was the second conductor under Zubin Mehta. So there was a competition for young, bright, they called it bright stars or shining stars of young classical. And I beat out kids that were 16, and I got this chance to play three places. And so it was, the first one was the Grand Am, was the Dorothy Chandler, and they bust in all these schools, and I played in front of all these kids and their parents and other people. And then Palos Verdes. I went to Palos Verdes.
Oh, my God.
I played there. And it was funny because kids wanted my autograph, and I was like,
that's amazing.
I'm 11. I play piano, but okay. So, yeah, I took that path. And then when I was 18, it was sort of like, what do I do with this? Do I become a performer professionally, which I wasn't interested in doing?
How come?
It scared me. It just was so stressful to perform for me.
Was it stressful at age 11 to do it, or is it just free and kind of fun? You were nervous.
I was nervous.
But you kicked ass, clearly, though.
Yeah, yeah. It's weird how the fingers just sort of, after you've played something, you know, so many times, the finger just kind of knows, just like a gymnast knows, like your body knows. But I was so fearful of you know, blanking on where to go next and what do I do. I mean, it's happened before and people wouldn't even know. I mean, I would be like, shit, I don't know what's coming up next, and then start again this one sequence, and then somehow my fingers found their way. So I, you know, we know there's tricks of the trade, but I wasn't interested in that lifestyle, performing for a living. And then I wasn't interested in teaching. So I did love movies already by that point. And I was like, I want to get into the film business, but easier said than done. Even if you're born and raised here, mm-hmm. where do you start? So, I got a job as a PA at an animation studio, which led me to The Simpsons ultimately.
What did you do for The Simpsons?
I worked for The Simpsons during their heyday of the 90s.
Amazing.
Yeah. I worked with Brad Bird. I worked with Rich Moore. I worked with David Silverman. Everyone who's super kicking ass right now.
We just had Phil Johnston on here last week, who co-wrote and directed the Wreck-It Ralph movies with Rich Moore. I know Rich Moore. That's amazing. What did you do on The Simpsons?
I was pushing old-fashioned drawings around and shipping them to Asia and getting them to do the animation. We did the key art, which we could only afford to do because American artists earned top dollar, and we poached from CalArts. CalArts was our huge, employment grounds, these kids. And there was a kit that you had to pass the test on because everyone needs to draw seamlessly. Like, you can't put your own style or stamp on Homer. You have to draw it like the same person drawing it. So there was a test kit that we gave out to everybody that was interested in working there. And the artists, the accomplished artists like Rich, they would be the ones to sort of judge if this person was able to qualify.
That sounds stressful. Speaking of, you know, having to perform on cue for somebody, that sounds really stressful to have to like recreate these iconic cartoon characters.
Yeah. It was really fun. I mean, we knew we were working on something great because the scripts were so hilarious. And Sam Simon was part of the crew then. And, now the producer list has grown even more. But there were a lot of people. It was a big, kitchen.
In all of those episodes from all of those years, this is like, what, mid-90s? Mm-hmm. Like, they all totally hold up and are like infinitely quotable.
Yeah.
That must've been really fun.
It was fun.
But was it stressful too? Was it long hours too?
Very long hours.
Yeah.
Very long hours. Technology had not kicked in. So things were being done very old school. Like, I mean, we were drawing, they would mess up on Homer or Lisa Simpson and then trash the cell or trash the artwork. So I was stepping on valuable artwork every day and not even thinking twice about it. Now I do have some cells and little snippets because artists are so funny. They just love to get their humor out on through the art. And so they would, they made me Hello Julia. Like, they made me a Hello Kitty.
That's cute.
and drew little whiskers on me and all that. So I have things like that. But yeah, it was very fun.
Okay, so you worked there until when? What year did you start?
I was not artistically satisfied. I was working around all this creativity, but I myself wasn't feeling like I was contributing creatively. And so I left and answered this Hollywood Reporter classified that said casting office seeking intern. And I went, and it ended up being this like A-list casting director working on huge stuff. The year that I interned, Waterworld, the Sabrina remake with Sydney Pollack directing, and this movie called IQ with Tim Robbins and Meg Ryan, I believe.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
So this is like late 80s.
Mid 90s. Yeah.
Wow.
And so, I mean, you know, when you're looking for the new Sabrina, you have every hot emerging and not an already established actresses vying for this iconic role. So I got to meet so many. And I just, you know, we opened up headshots, old school style. So I literally interviewed with the guy, and then he goes, "Do you want to start now?" And
I go, yeah. What are you doing in 15 minutes? Nothing.
So I got down on the floor, and he goes, "Here's the letter opener." And I was just ripping open manila envelopes of headshots. Wow. And everyone knows now the trade secret of the A pile, the B pile, and then the C pile.
Okay. I don't know what that is. Explain that to me.
You know, like, agencies and the kinds of the level of clients that they represent. So I learned what kinds of clients each agency's kind of known for. You know, there's the Gersh and the UTAs back then, and writers and artists that don't even exist anymore. But they had the solid sort of supporting role type actors. Now they have more leading actors, but the leads all were at the big three at the time. Mm-hmm. So I just got to know and familiarize myself the landscape of what casting was about through this internship.
So prior to this, though, did you have any idea what casting was exactly? Like what it meant?
No. I just was intrigued by that because I was most moved by a performance when I watched film. So I just loved actors. I remember so much about a performance. And so it was like, oh, wow, this job exists. And I have a knack for it. I remember people's names. I kind of have this really good memory with just who even the Rolodex of memory of like knowing who they're represented by and being able to call right on a dime instead of looking it up and going who's on, you know, who they're rep by. So everything was like up here, and I just sparked to it.
So for the person who's not an actor, for the people listening to this who are just regular folks who don't work in this business at all, mm-hmm. Walk us through what happens when someone goes up for a role. Like their agent, what? Their agent puts them up for it or tells them it's coming and you're seeing folks. Like what is the whole process if you're casting for a part?
Well, I get a script, and for me, I've worked with a lot of first-time filmmakers, so I don't have previous work per se to compare what their vibe is and what their style is and their tastes are. But I read something, and I think that's actually a good thing to not always know how they, you know, who they've cast in the past and things like that, because it's like a blank slate. And so my interpretation could spark something in them that they've lived with this material for so long that they never thought of it that way. So those are the joys that come with casting, the unexpected surprises, the happy accidents. But I get a good, I feel like limited budget, first time filmmaker. Is the material on the page strong enough to draw the kinds of actors that I envision for this? Because they're not going to make a lot of money usually. And it's an unproven director, you know? So, and then once that begins, I come up with like a list. There's different levels of actor-friendly directors I've worked with. Some are voracious moviegoers themselves or watchers, so they have a very good idea of even some of the not household name actors. But some don't know anybody, and so I have to navigate that. And I come up with a list that I believe is realistic. they, part of the challenges is, I mean, I'm veering off, but you know, a lot of first time filmmakers are like, well, Sam Rockwell does a lot of indies and I really think he'd be, I'm like, you're not getting Sam Rockwell.
At this point, you're not getting Sam
Rockwell.
Well,
at this point, yes.
20 years ago, maybe you might have gotten Sam Rockwell, yes. But now you're not.
But, you know, they think because, I mean, you and I have watched a lot through our affiliation with Film Independent. And we are sometimes like, wow, they got some really good people in this movie. And yet the movie did not succeed. So I just think it's not a guaranteed thing. Sure, names help, but you have to make a good movie. So I also have to do that, you know, like bring them to reality because they have this pre-list from their financiers or whatever that says, these are the approved names. I'm like, well, duh, you know.
But they're working it backward that way.
Yes.
These are the approved names. Yeah. They haven't begun to ponder like what's really out there.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
So people come in. So you get a script from a filmmaker. Let's hypothetically say it's Sean Baker and it's Starlet.
Okay.
Right. So you get that script and you're working with Sean. And what sort of conversations do you have then to make sure you're on the same page when you are looking for certain different kinds of actors for certain roles?
Sean is, you know, he likes them raw and very authentic. So when I came on Starlet, he had a real porn star that was not, you know, even porn stars have evolved. So she wasn't like this double D, you know, blonde, platinum blonde girl. She was sort of this edgy, kind of gothy, cool, dark haired girl and had never done a movie before. And so I was going under the guise of casting everyone around her that she was settled in her role.
Interesting. Okay. And that's a central component and you can find folks to work around it. Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so when he had a table read, she was not nailing it and he started to get reservations. And so then that came back onto my plate to look for the pivotal, you know, role. Because I was already tasked with finding an older woman that was, hadn't had a lot of work done, was really an old woman, was believable in that role, and going to work for $100 a day.
It's a very specific little Venn diagram slice you have there.
And Sean Baker was not Sean Baker
right.
at that time.
Like, Tangerine had not come out yet.
No.
Florida Project had not come out yet. Yeah.
No, he was Sean Baker from New York making his first West Coast film and having an 80-something-year-old woman and a young porn star and strike up this unlikely friendship. And so, yeah, I, you know, And Sean being wanting the real deal all the time. So that was a challenge. But yeah, we just had a conversation. And then I also, you know, of his wants. And then when he told me that porn star girl was not going to work out, we just started to dig deep into the world of that girl that was believable in that profession, but also a good actor. You know, kudos to him because, you know, Dree does not have huge boobs. But it that was not the focus of the part, you know, to have a body that you believed in porn. You just had to have somebody who was in that industry and, you know, we bought it. And so she was great.
So when you have like an open call for something, mm-hmm. how does that work? Like, you put an ad out for, we're looking for XYZ kind of character for this small project or whatever it is. Mm. People come to you. Mm. What is that kind of situation like? What's that kind of day like?
It's a big day. It's an exhausting day. Because, you know, I mean, we've heard a lot of discovery stories where I was just tagging along with my friend.
It's always that. I came from moral support.
Yeah. The girl from Precious,
Gabrielle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, those are all the stories that people, are like, I wasn't even thinking about me. I was just coming, but
Yalitza Aparicio in Roma supposedly came along with her sister. I want to say. Yeah.
Yes. So you do turn over every stone because they're there and you can get a sense quickly if they're capable of something. The consciousness is a big deal. Like sometimes even with kids, the ones that are just they could care less if a camera's on or not. And there's just something about them that's not suddenly rigid, you know, and a very awareness of self-consciousness. So those are the challenges. But so there's, yeah, different levels that you put these newbies through, drills. And then I think you make a note and a list of the ones that are worth exploring deeper after open call. But it is finding that one diamond in the rough in a big, you know, pile. And so it's not always successful, but I think, you know, enough success has come from it that when you're looking for something very special and fresh and you want to dig deep, it's worth doing.
How do you know when you've gotten it right? How do you know when you have found that diamond?
Sometimes it takes a lot of work. Like when you know that it's there, but they still need to, you know, there's just so many levels. Like you have to be believable in the role. You have to memorize the dialogue. You have to know where and how to stand and be aware to play to camera, but then not be aware of the camera. I mean, there's a lot of nuances that come with something like that. So if you have the luxury of working with someone like Starlet, we had Besetka Johnson, who had never done a movie in her life, and she was found at the Y in Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
And she was 80. Well, by the time we worked with her, maybe she was like 85. But anyways, she had never done... I gave her a script. I go slow. I don't want to overwhelm them. So once she was in our periphery, I handed her a script and said, read this. She read it and she goes, okay, now what? You know? And I was like, well, now we're going to try a scene. And she wasn't comfortable with how this woman came off. She thought that she was a little mean and she didn't feel comfortable being that mean. And I'm like, you're playing, you know, Sean and I would massage the situation and say, this isn't you. You're playing a part. We're not going to say, oh, Besetka's so mean. It's this character that's kind of abrasive.
It's acting.
Yes. So that it was really baby steps like that with her. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But then with a film like you also worked on, But I'm a Cheerleader, that was one of the first films that you cast. Mm-hmm. You have actresses who had experience and then have since gone on to do many, many great things. So how do you know when you have an ensemble like Natasha Lyonne, Michelle Williams, Clea DuVall, mm-hmm. and RuPaul is in that movie.
As a man.
Oh, that's right, as a man in that. Yeah. How do you know when you have the right alchemy with a cast like that? You've got them all, you've got the right pieces and they're all in the right places.
That movie was ahead of its time. And I think we had a female writer director, which was super rare at that time. And she really knew her characters very inside and out. And so
it's a comedy about a lesbian who goes to a reform camp.
Yeah. It's a gay rehab yeah. camp mm-hmm. movie and campy at that too. and all of those people in that cast are so remarkably accomplished today. But at that time we knew they were talented, but they, you know, good luck getting someone to write a check for this on, like, not only is it controversial subject matter, but then we have a bunch of unknowns. And kudos to the people behind that they saw the visionariness of this movie. And so they said, you know, they trusted Jamie Babbitt and us. We worked very, very closely with her. It's kind of all hands on deck, kind of at that kind of level. Where, you know, if she has a relationship with somebody through her personal doing her directing work, and she thought of this actress that she had worked with before, and things like that. We just kind of put the pieces together, and they all fell into place, and everybody wanted to do this movie. It was also a really important thing. Like, everyone was super excited and knew they were working on something fun and special and believed in the message and stuff, so it was great.
And that's probably true with a lot of the films that you worked on, because they are indies. Mm-hmm. People have to really, really want to be there and tell that story.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And it just is helpful when you're working on really unique and special material, when I'm on the phone pitching it to an agent, that those are the strengths behind what I can do to sell the project, because it's not, they will obviously make money, better money somewhere else. But it's, is it going to be in a notable festival? Is it going to get some kind of recognition or spotlight? Is it a role that they've never played before? And, you know, they want to be able to show that side of them. There's just all little, those variables that really come into the casting thought process.
That's a really interesting part of your job that I had not even considered, because I'm envisioning you sitting at a table with a stack of names and headshots, but it hadn't occurred to me that you're also pitching the project to people that you really hope will come and read for it. Mm-hmm. How do you manage that part of the job? That's a totally different personality skill.
Yeah. Well, that's why for me, I take on things that I can speak authentically and from the heart about, because when I'm behind a script and I think I'm working on something really special, it just comes through in the way that I pitch it. And so, the agents are all looking for that special diamond also for their, clients. And so, yeah, I think it's a good, collaborative. And I also feel at this juncture now, I have a really good track record with the films that I've worked on, and they know when I'm calling them that I'm not calling to waste their time, that when I say something special, that, you know, they can trust that it is.
It'll be substantive and smart, and it'll be pushing buttons. And let's talk about Spa Night, because it's a movie that I love. It was directed by our mutual friend,
Andrew Ahn.
To tell a story about the child of Korean immigrants living in Los Angeles. It must have been a pretty special job for you.
It was. I loved what it was about. Mixing the Korean spa world, which everyone loves and, you know, takes advantage of, but then exposing another facet to that spa, with, this underground scene that he discovered, or, you know, I mean, it's loosely biographical, but, it's a family place. And then it's also this kind of subversive, could be a subversive sexual place. The challenges was, we had a lot less Asian actors to pull from at that time. And it wasn't that long ago.
It's like 4 years ago, right?
Yeah. Okay. But it's still, it's not like it was now. And so, finding a bilingual Korean, young Korean male actor that was that character, like living in Los Angeles in Koreatown, but still very much with his, you know, enveloped with his immigrant parents' life. And so he kind of bounced back and forth with the language. And then also being very good. And, we found, you know, we would find some elements that work, but then it didn't check all the boxes. And so ultimately it was down to two actors, one that was established that had a following, and he was very good and very talented. And then this unknown actor that felt very right for the role. But, you know, the team had a discussion about it, and I knew what I wanted, and I was hoping that, you know, it was a collective decision, and it was. And I think our decision paid off. The lesser known actor got the part, but he was, got a special jury prize for acting at Sundance that year.
His name is
Joe Saya.
Yes. And yeah, it's a really lovely film, and there is great authenticity to it, mm-hmm. in the look of it and where it's shot and the pacing of it. But yeah, the casting in that is so great, because you do truly feel like you are watching real people live their lives, mm-hmm. in a very recognizable but underrepresented slice of LA. So
very much.
So good job. Good job, Julia.
Thank you.
Are there more opportunities now? You say that 4 years ago there weren't a lot of places for Asian actors, Korean actors. Are we finding that people's minds are opening to the possibility of having different kinds of actors from different kinds of backgrounds play roles that maybe would have only gone to a white actor before?
I definitely think so. I'm very encouraged. I mean, we can always say it's not enough, but right now, I have seen casting, just the landscape changed so much. And Invasion LA is something that I started because, one, I selfishly wanted the casting community to have better Asian actors to choose from. And so I said, you know, I always tell these Asian actors that want to get into the business or are in the business, like, you, just because the wave is the wave of opportunity is opening means you have to be ready for that. You know, just because you're Asian doesn't make you qualified. You have to be good.
You have to have actual craft.
Yes. You have to be good.
Describe what Invasion LA is.
Invasion LA came, sprung out of me finding a lot of Asian actors auditioning, and there were cultural differences that I felt needed to be addressed. If you're a recent transplant or, you know, really kind of came from Asia and you wanted to break into the business here, there's a lot of cultural differences in taste, whether it's how much makeup you wear or the hairstyle or how you dress for an audition. And then there's the uncertainty of, do I have to have everything memorized? Can I hold the paper? Can I audition looking into the camera, or do I look at the reader? What's a slate? You know, what does that entail? What do sides mean? How do I get an agent? Do I pay to get an agent? No, you never pay. You know, just the pitfalls of the naivete of not knowing, and all the sharks out there mm-hmm. that are looking to take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. And then also just turning them on to other Asian actors and getting a community going, because I think actors with other actors are such a valuable way to hear about other roles or find out about the trials and tribulations through another actor's personal experiences, and it helps you not make those same mistakes. Or, you know, just there's so many ways to enhance the Asian actor and the experience. So I kind of, you know, can open to doing classes or one-on-one consultation. A lot of parents who have young Asian kids that are singing and posting themselves on videos and love performing, but they don't, the parents are just like, how do I start? What do I do? My kid just really loves this and seems to have enthusiasm for it, but is she or he good? Like, is this something that I think that, you know, and also the fact that it is now becoming, it is a viable career choice for Asians. Before it was sort of like, oh, good luck making a living playing an incidental role every now and again. And then every Asian actor in LA is in that waiting room trying to get that role.
And they are small supporting roles ordinarily, but that's changing, right? You see a John Cho in a film like Searching.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
You see an entire film like Crazy Rich Asians, you yes. know, so that's got to be encouraging
and,
for
and
folks
all shapes
to see.
And sizes, yes. not just pretty pinup calendar type girls. Well, like Asian, in Asia, it is a very still very you have to be good looking to get into. Like, I remember trying to get my friend's mom, a Korean mom, to try out for Spa Night's mom role, and she was like, me? I'm not an actor. Like, why in the world would you be interested in me? I'm like, because you're authentic, you know, and you're real, and I want you to try to bring that to the screen. So
did she try out?
Yes.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, good. Well, she tried at least, though, right? She was open-minded to a new experience.
Yes, mm-hmm. she tried. But, I mean, Awkwafina is another great example. Like, you know, she is definitely her own person, and there's no one like her, and I think that's great.
It must be encouraging, too, after years of, you know, Emma Stone being cast as Chinese, Scarlett Johansson being cast in a traditionally Japanese yeah. role. I mean, even going back to, Long Duck Dong and Mickey Rooney and Breakfast at Tiffany's, it must be encouraging to have more authentic portrayals of Asians on screen.
For sure.
Not cringe-inducing ones.
No, and to have, the choices keep building. Like, when someone like Awkwafina is up there, then it inspires another young Asian girl to go, I want to do that. And so the pool just keeps growing, and then we have not just one, you know, one person to choose from. Like, John Cho used to be the guy mm-hmm. that fit that guy next door role, or the best friend to the male lead, or things like that. And now he is the male lead mm-hmm. and he is not the only one out there.
I mean, that's a role that would have gone to a Tom Hanks type actor in the '80s, you know, mm-hmm. a superstar leading man. And he is a superstar leading man.
Yeah.
And we talked about this, about how, you know, he's on screen the entire time, mostly in close up, having yeah. to make it all work. So that's got to be exciting too, and inspiring for other actors of every kind of ethnicity, but Asian actors especially, to say, I can do this.
Yeah. And the support from behind too. because, you know, his agents may be for it, but the people writing, you know, financing it, the filmmakers, everybody has to be on board with this vision. So that's one example where it all worked.
So minds have changed pretty in the most last few years, pretty recently then, as far as approaching casting, it sounds like, in that regard. Was there a moment that changed? Was there like a watershed, or has it been just progressive?
Well, I do commercial casting too. And so I started to see that the ad agencies would say open to all ethnicities. So it gave us freedom to try stuff out and bring in people that it didn't look like it was written for that particular kind of person on the page, but let's try it anyways. And it was an opportunity for the casting community to really bring diversity, you know, to take action with that, not just say it, but, and that's also where Invasion came from, because I was like, oh, you know, because it's still new for the Asian community and other people of color, that the white market is still the strongest market, where I can just get pages and pages and pages of submissions that are mostly Caucasian, and I have so many choices. And then it'll be like every 50 people, and there'll be a few people with some color going on there. So, you know, the odds are if you're picking from such a lesser pool, then it just keeps getting, the choices become less too. So, I think, commercials started to really, now I see like mixed race couples left and right on commercials, but that's slowly where I started to see it change. And then, sort of really saying, that we need to make best efforts to cast it very colorful, which I loved. Mm-hmm. And then now I think it's not even, I mean, it's a conversation still, but I don't think people are as, they blink twice about it anymore.
Whereas before they would say like, we're not looking for an Asian actor here.
Yeah. Yeah. And whoa, wait, Asian husband and, you know, a Latino wife. I'm not sure that works. And then how do we cast the kids, you know? And now it's just, I see so many choices where kids are ethnically ambiguous. And that's another commercial term. Ethnically ambiguous. But everyone is ethnically ambiguous. I just met, I had an actor come in yesterday whose mom was from Mumbai and her father was albino.
Wow.
I know. And she looked like she could play many things. Mm-hmm. And she struggled with that, because if you're in a room full of girls that are Indian, she's not Indian compared to them. But then when she's in a room full of white girls or, you know, Latino girl, Latina, Latinx actor, she's like, I'm not quite there. So she's struggling with that. And I was just trying to help her embrace who she was.
There will be a place for her.
Yeah. Yes,
for sure. So regardless of background or experience or ethnicity, what is a mistake that people too often make in auditioning? Like, what tips would you give aspiring actors going into an audition?
I find a lot of people come unprepared. I think preparation just allows you to put your best foot forward. You know, I think that I don't know what goes on their end. You know, like if you're lucky enough to be an actor that gets multiple auditions a day or a week and you have a lot to learn, it's definitely a challenge to budget your time and to put the time needed to really learn something. But I don't think any casting director expects memorization, but it's sort of like when you have it memorized, it just gives you the freedom to play around a lot more. And if a director, if you're at a callback, for sure at a callback, you need to have it memorized, because a director is going to throw different scenarios at you, maybe even have you switch roles. If it's a chemistry reading and he wants you to try the opposite character's role, like if you know that scene well, you're going to know your partner's part too.
I see. So maybe like they panic in the moment and go, oh my God, I only know my half of it or whatever it is. So is that then more important than what you're wearing, how you look, what your energy is? Knowing your stuff is the key,
right,
going in?
I definitely encourage a well-groomed and hygienic appearance.
Take a shower. Brush your teeth before you come in.
But that's, no, I mean, you can wear a hoodie and a sweat. I mean, commercials, they need to have it spelled out a little bit more. So I really am emphatic about if there's a specific wardrobe choice, like if you're a doctor, put on a white jacket.
Right.
It just helps, you know. But most commercial actors kind of have all that in their closet of tricks anyways. But for theatrical, no. I think it's all about the material. And I don't need you to dress the part unless... you know, I mean, if the girl is sexy, you might want to bring that to the table versus baggy jeans and a big oversized sweatshirt, you know, but still it doesn't matter. I think you have pictures that show, look how I clean up, and just come in and do your best job with the role.
And does it help that we have like IMDb? Like, does that help for actors who've been around for a little bit just to see what they have looked like in previous roles? Or do you just focus on who is in front of you at that moment?
Oh, no, it really helps.
Uh-huh.
A lot of filmmakers that I work with also are first timers, like I said. And there's actors that won't read because they're just at a place in their career where they don't need to.
I see. Like they're above it.
Well, no.
Beyond it.
No, I don't want to put it like that. Right. It's they've got a body of work that shows, you know, that shows their capability of being able to be very varied. Okay. So, especially when there's an unproven director who's making his first film and I'm courting some very veteran and accomplished actors, but maybe they haven't played a role like this before. And the director's like he's struggling to take that leap of faith. It's so helpful to be able to call up previous work and say, look, you know, he played something so different from this other role that he's known for or whatnot. So it's great to see that body of work on a demo reel or all just the clips that are available on YouTube or whatnot. And then pictures too. Yeah. Just see how, I mean, that's sort of why I watch talk shows and a lot of things, just to see how they are when they're just not as scripted and styled or for something for a specific role. I like to see how they are when they're just at the Spirit Awards.
Right. And that might give you a glimmer of alternate facets of their ability.
Just how they move. Like I've noticed somebody's walk before. I've noticed a lisp before.
Oh.
I've noticed things that I'm like, oh, I'm going to make a mental note there. They have this little quirk or an idiosyncratic thing that's definitely theirs that we didn't notice because it's disguised under all this movie magic. And I like to see sometimes all those little things.
So when you have the whole cast in place, how do you know it's right? How do you know you've got that magical combination of everyone that's going to be the right combo for this project? Mm. Or do you? Or are you constantly in the back of your head thinking, oh gosh, maybe we should have put this person in here and that person in there?
It's a lot. I mean, depends on the film. There's could be lots of chefs in the kitchen, and you know, casting director's job is really to present the best choices, and we don't ultimately get a say in the decision making. Sometimes I weigh in. I'm passionate about who I think is right, and then really it's the producers and the director who ultimately decide. With a lot of them, I think you feel it when it's right, but you do take a lot of chances too, and you don't always know. We've watched a lot of films, you and I, and sometimes the best of them, it's just not working.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's not because they're not talented.
I was going to ask you, can you watch a film and just immerse yourself in it, just enjoy it? Or are you constantly sort of in the back of your head shuffling through who is in these roles, and does that make sense?
I try to just watch it, you know, but it's, you know, we're in the profession, so it just, that stuff just creeps in, you know, you notice little things that maybe a normal movie going person wouldn't, but I mean, there's a certain amount of judgment.
Right. People have asked me like, can I just enjoy a film? Yeah, I can enjoy a film, but I'm also reacting to my reactions of it in an analytical way. Mm-hmm. It's hard not to. I want to mention before we go, the last thing is, The Last Black Man in San Francisco, which I have not seen, and I hear it's amazing.
I mean, that movie was, it was really something that I relished because I'm an Asian American casting director, and just like actors, casting directors can get pigeonholed too. And I got this great opportunity to cast a predominantly black cast, and I'm so proud of that cast. And I think it worked. It is an example of where all everything's working, cast wise and everything else, the music, the cinematography, and the story. But
what's it about, real fast?
It's about a lifelong San Franciscan and his multi-generations in that city, and this house that he has in his memory of the best times of his family's life. And now that neighborhood is completely changed and gentrified, and that house is vacant and on the market. And he kind of gets in there and recreates a scenario in that house, and it's just about him and his identity with the city and how he doesn't recognize it anymore. And there's just so many beautiful layers. There's a friendship layer, and one of the cast members, Tashina Arnold, says that you will not see a black man portrayed like this as in this movie. So I think, I just think so many people get something out of it. It's fun too. You know, it's a funny movie. It's poignant. You get, San Francisco, you get the inhabitants of San Francisco, all the weirdos and cool freaks of San Francisco. And then, and then just this family, this very personal story.
It looks beautiful. It looks like it couldn't be more timely given how that city is changing, but it also feels like a timeless kind of fairy tale element to the vibe of it.
Mm-hmm. I went to visit the set, and the Tenderloin is one of the last remaining, like, you know, boroughs or city parts of the city that still feels like the old San Francisco.
Like raw and edgy and maybe a little dangerous.
A little dirty, mm-hmm. A little gritty. You see all kinds of people on the street, and it's not just baby carriages and whatnot.
Well, I can't wait to see it, and I can't wait to see your beautiful work in casting it.
Thank you.
Thank you for seeing me and hanging out with me. This is really fun. I learned a lot. I think people think they know what casting is. I thought I knew what casting was, and
yeah,
I learned a lot.
Thank you, and I'm glad you did. It's a job I enjoy, and you're right. Not a lot of people really know the intricacies of casting, so I'm happy to share it.
Yes, it's important. I think people take for granted how important it is. They don't realize how much it matters.
It does.
So thank you for being a badass at your job.
Oh, thank you.
This was so fun. And next time we have Marcellus Reynolds, who was a model, who was on Big Brother Season 3 and Big Brother All-Stars. And he has a book coming out about black supermodels.
Wow.
A giant coffee table book of gorgeous photographs of like amazing, beautiful black women who are models.
I look forward to it.
Yes. So thank you for sticking around with Breakfast All Day and Breakfast All Day a la carte. We will have many, many more of these. Bye.